asked Reese. 3 hours and 32 minutes until Umbrella lands, 4 hours until he goes on stage. Every protectee or principal had a Secret Service code name. Umbrella was a reference to the 187th Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division, nicknamed by the Japanese as Rakasans, which meant Falling Down Umbrella Men. The president had commanded the Rakasans during Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, before being selected as vice president by the previous administration. "We have less than 4 hours, so do what you can. I know you'll come up with something. Out here." Freddie ended the call and turned to their Secret Service liaison. "Can you take us to the site?"
"Let's go. I'll drive. And let me get you two some lapel pins."
Chapter 79. Odessa, Ukraine. October. Reese and Freddie retrieved their gear bags and weapons from the back of the agency SUV and thanked Douglas for the ride. Agent Shear led them to a white Hyundai minivan that was obviously from a local rental agency's fleet.
"No Suburban?" Reese teased.
"Please. The advance team gets the shaft. All the cool guys on the PPD, that's the president's detail, get their vehicles flown in on C-17s for game day, and we get whatever Avis can't rent out that week."
Kim pulled out of the hotel and navigated the local streets like a native. She'd obviously spent some time in the area as part of the advance team.
"What's your background, Kim? Did you come straight to the Secret Service?" Freddie asked.
"No, I went to Annapolis. Then the Marine Corps. Got out as a captain, tried to go to work in the family's insurance business, but that made me want to blow my brains out. Applied for this job 5 years ago and have been here ever since. I love it."
"What did you do in the Corps?" Reese asked.
"Intel mainly. Supported some high-speed units, but didn't leave the FOB much."
"MARSOC?"
"They call them Raiders now, but yeah, I was attached as an intel officer."
"That's right. The artists formerly known as MARSOC. Hard to keep up with all of the name changes."
"I was attached to Det 1 in 2004 for a couple of months," Reese responded. "That was a solid group. I really learned a lot from them. Especially Major K. He used to run their Mountain Warfare Training Center. Great guy."
"He was squared away," Kim remembered.
"Was Gunny Gutierrez still around when you were there?" Reese asked.
"He sure was. Small world."
"It is indeed."
After showing her credentials to local police and making her way through the roadblocks, Agent Shear parked the minivan on Primorsky Boulevard and led the men toward the site of the speech. They walked along the gray cobblestone driveway past an impressive 19th-century columned building that had, at some point, been the residence of someone important. The gated perimeter had already been set up and the temporary fences funneled pedestrians into a tent with several airport-style magnetometers and package scanners. The uniformed personnel recognized the Secret Service agent and waved her through. As they cleared the checkpoint and rounded the building, the colonnade they'd viewed on the iPad imagery was directly in front of them. The area was smaller than Reese had expected it to be. The site had obviously been chosen for television viewing rather than its ability to accommodate a large physical audience. A stage had been built in front with two lecterns a few yards apart from each other. Last-minute preparations were being made by a variety of workers, while security personnel from the United States, Russia, and Ukraine moved busily about. They walked up onto the stage and looked around. The site of the speech sat on a high bluff, with the ground falling off sharply toward the sea below. From the land side of the colonnade, the site left very few options for a sniper. Tall trees and buildings surrounded the structure, leaving no discernible line of sight shooting lanes that wouldn't be locked down by the Secret Service. A long and modern pedestrian bridge connected the area from stage right to a more built-up area of the city, but only the rooftops and high windows of those buildings offered a shot toward the stage, and all would be occupied by authorities. Each member of the team spent several minutes taking in the scene, looking for something that had been overlooked by the other dozen sets of eyes
that had studied it as part of the overall security assessment. Reese broke the silence first.
"I'll be honest, Kim, this is a good spot."
"I agree," Freddy added. "The only thing that bothers me is the port, but you're saying it's been locked down?"
"Yep. Everything within 2,000 meters has been searched and secured. We have drones up looking for IR signatures and dog teams that have been working it all night and morning. The port is secure."
"What are we missing?" Reese asked himself as much as the others. Far out on the horizon, past the closest set of docks and through a forest of dock cranes, sat a massive green and red tanker-style vessel with a handful of colorful shipping containers stacked on the deck. Strain pulled a laser rangefinder unit from his pack and aimed it toward the ship, bracing it against one of the columns for stability.
2,100 meters. Technically, you could make a shot from that far pier, but it would be a long one.
Sure would, especially in this wind. You think that's a legitimate threat, Freddy? What's the world record shot these days, anyway?
These records are changing every year or two, but the longest confirmed real-world shot was taken in Iraq by a Canadian sniper in 2017. Went 3,871 yards. He used a Macmillan TAC-50 like the ones we used to use. The shot took 10 seconds to reach the target.
"That's crazy," Reese said, shaking his head.
"It's damn fine shooting, buddy."
"No, I meant that you can remember all that stuff," Reese smiled. "How about on a controlled range?"
"To the best of my knowledge, a shooter out of Texas hit a 3-mile shot with a 408 Shytac in 2018. Before that, one of our old sniper instructors had it at 2.8 miles with the same round. Keep in mind, those are not under combat conditions and were done with the best rifle scope combinations available, shot by the most highly trained and capable snipers on Earth."
"So from those cranes and that ship," Reese said, gesturing to the distance, "it's a low-percentage shot, but not out of the realm of possibility. With the guns and optics that are out there now, it could be done. Could you have some people take a look at that far pier, Kim?"
"It's outside of the perimeter, but sure, I'll have someone check it out."
Agent Shear walked off a few steps and made a phone call. Gesturing with her hand as she spoke, she tried to describe the exact location of the tanker before hanging up and rejoining the group.
"That's the oil terminal, so it's not open to the public. It's gated, and local police are manning it. They're sending some of our people over there to look around, and we'll do a sweep with the UAVs as well."
"Okay, good. Let's keep looking. I still feel like something is off."
"The Secret Service does extensive research into the threats to POTUS," Kim explained, "at every location, on every itinerary. Ever since President Kennedy, we have been extremely sensitive to sniper threats against the president, for obvious reasons. No one wants to relive the nightmare that was Dallas. So, ever since 1963, we've kept data of every military and law enforcement sniper, and with the advent of social media, we've kept tabs, using open-source information, on civilians going to shooting schools run by former military snipers. Anytime POTUS makes a stop, we've cross-referenced everything in a given area, including incoming travelers, whose names we get from TSA, to those former MIL-LE and civilian-trained long-range shooters. They each get checked out, and any in the vicinity of a POTUS stop are flagged. Facial recognition technology helps a lot."
"That's thorough," Reese remarked. "But here you don't have that information on foreign-trained snipers."
"The database is fairly robust, thanks to the folks at the NSA, but you're right. Nothing's 100%. We have good intel on U.S., Canadian, and European-trained snipers, who are the ones that coincidentally have the best shot at taking out the president. According to our assessment, other countries just don't have the training or equipment required to make a shot past 2,000 yards. That's stretching it, even for us."
Reese nodded and looked out to sea. "The Shoshone is here, Kim. I know it. He's in place. He's waiting. That sniper is here." Oliver Gray recognized James Reese from the media coverage following his attacks on various civilian and military individuals across the United States the previous year.
He looks a lot like his father did.
Reese and his two colleagues had taken no interest in him as they walked past in front of the Bootlegger, a gangster-themed pub that sat on the ground floor of a taller building near the colonnade. Gray was sitting at a table on the sidewalk reading the local Russian-language newspaper and drinking coffee like just another local going about his day. Since the pub sat well below the high ground where the presidents would speak, the street where it was located would remain open until just before the event began. The fact that Reese was walking with another Westerner and what looked to be a female Secret Service agent meant that he had worked his way back into the good graces of the U.S. government. This explained why Jules Landry had fallen off the radar, which meant that this operation had been compromised. Still, it was too late to call it off now. They would never get another opportunity like it. Gray had long since passed the point of no return, and the operation had reached a similar point. There was no going back. Chapter 80.
Tell me about your counter-sniper setup, Reese said.
The three Americans were standing on the roof of a large apartment building in the midst of renovation that overlooked the colonnade. A Secret Service sharpshooter, dressed from head to toe in black BDUs, was setting up what looked like an AR-10 on the roof parapet. A giant pair of well-worn 1980s vintage Steiner binoculars sat nearby. Next to the American was another black-clad sniper, wearing a matching beret with a colorful badge. His rifle, a black chassis-style bolt-action with a Night Force scope, was cradled in a tripod mount alongside a separate tripod that held both a Leica spotting scope and a pair of range-finding binoculars. It wasn't lost on Reese or Strain that the Russians seemed to have superior equipment to the Americans, at least when it came to optics.
Well, it depends on where we are, but in this case we have our guys paired up with Russian counterparts from the FSO, one U.S. shooter and one Russian, Kim explained. In some countries our folks aren't permitted to carry weapons, but they always at least shadow the local shooters so they can coordinate with the PPD.
Don't your people usually work in pairs? Asked Freddy.
Generally, yes, but not on this trip. This arrangement was a negotiated deal between the Russians and the Ukrainians. Besides, budget cuts hit us hard. We're low on agents as it is. This allows us to spread our people over a wider radius.
Sounds like a recipe for disaster, Freddy commented.
Let's hope not.
What rifle is that, Freddy? Asked Reese.
I think it's called a Tochnost. It's Russia's new sniper rifle. Supposedly a great gun, but I don't have any experience with it.
What about assaulters? What assets do we have on the ground? Reese asked, beginning to pace.
Cat, that's our counter-assault team, will be near the stage. Their job is to cover the PPD while they get Umbrella to safety. The Russians have their own team with a similar role. Neither is going to divert away from their principal. If there's a threat somewhere that we need to move on, the Ukrainian alphas will be the ones to do it.
Forgive me for bringing up the elephant in the room, Kim, but don't the Russians and Ukrainians hate each other? Russia is occupying Crimea, for Christ's sake, Freddy pointed out.
Our threat assessment teams analyze all that. Us agents, we leave the politics to the politicians.
That reminds me to check in with Andy.
Freddy stepped away from the counter-snipers and made a call. Reese and Kim followed and leaned in to hear the conversation.
This is Andy.
It's Strain. Anything new?
I was actually about to call you. I just heard from a contact at State. During his speech today, President Zubarov is going to announce that they're giving back Crimea. In exchange, the United States will drop its sanctions against Moscow, and the EU will buy a bunch of Russian natural gas. Our president praises Russia, and everyone shakes hands and sings Kumbaya.
That doesn't sound like it's in line with Andrenov's vision, Reese chimed in.
Not at all. This is the kind of move that would make him want to take out a president, and if I know Andrenov, he'll find a way to spin it to his advantage.
How so?
If President Zubarov goes down, the new president will have the support he needs to retaliate. That means he's going to blame it either on the Ukrainians, Azerbaijanis, or someone within their own borders that they want to take out, probably Muslims in the Caucasus. When Russian tanks start rolling farther into Ukraine or Turkey on another land grab, they'll be able to wave around a photo of their dead president as justification. Like I told you when you were here, this is the last gasp of a dying empire. Desperate people do desperate things. Hell, if our president was hit as well, we might even support them. And I'm just giving you my best guess as to what's going on. We're not perfect. We thought Iraq had WMDs, remember?
That rings a bell, Reese said. Keep working it. I'm going to see if Agent Shear can get you a list of the local security forces. Maybe we're overlooking someone there. I'll have PID send them a full list, she confirmed.
Okay, thanks all. Out here, Freddy ended the call.
I think we just checked the motive block, Reese observed.
Agent Shear looked at her watch.
I'll pass all this along, but we're going to need more. Umbrella lands in less than an hour.
Chapter 81
Umbrella is en route, 5 miles out. He'll be here in 10 minutes.
Strain had kitted up with a low-vis mag carrier. His carbine was slung to his left side. Reese had both 9mm pistols, courtesy of his new employer. They were on their own radios, which were not compatible with the ones used by the Secret Service. That meant that Reese stayed close to Agent Shear so she could relay any relevant information from her feed. It was the best that they could muster on such short notice. The former SEALs had placed themselves on opposing ends of the Teoshin Pedestrian Bridge, an elevated structure that gave them a good vantage point and reasonable mobility. Reese and Shear were closest to the colonnade where the presidents would be speaking, while Freddy was positioned on the west end. He had given Reese the sat phone since he was in a better position to coordinate assets and intelligence, should that become necessary. The streets had been closed and the route had been cleared, a crowd of several hundred people all having been frisked physically and electronically by uniformed Secret Service agents filled the space in front of the colonnade. No backpacks, satchels, or briefcases were allowed inside the perimeter. A brass band was set up at stage left, facing the direction of the pedestrian bridge. Television cameras were ready to film the event, with the agreement that the live feed would be sequestered until the respective leaders were on site. A team of Ukrainian police had searched the pier that had concerned the Americans and found nothing out of the ordinary. Reese peered into every probable hide site that he could find using his binoculars. The tough part was that this area had virtually no middle ground. The shooter was either very close or extremely distant.
I know you're here. Where are you hiding? Umbrella is 5 minutes out. You see anything, Freddy?
Negative, Reese, his friend responded over the radio.
The shipping container sat at the top of the large stack of identical boxes riding on the deck of the freighter, giving them a commanding view of the harbor. They had no communications devices in the container, so everything depended on the clock. Cell phones, satellite phones, and radios all gave off electronic signatures that could be detected remotely and would give away their location. If there was anything the Americans were good at, it was locating and targeting communications equipment, specifically cell phones.
Lessons learned the hard way.
The ventilation system had been shut off 12 hours earlier to prevent heat signatures from escaping, and though the oxygen tanks that had been fitted inside allowed them to breathe through medical masks, the heavily insulated